Hi, I'm Ben Rizzuto, wealth strategist at Janus Henderson Investors. For 90 years, we've worked to help clients achieve superior financial outcomes and fulfill our purpose of investing in a brighter future together. To learn more, go to janushenderson.com.
Russia attacks targets in western Ukraine in a warning to NATO.
The airstrike is perhaps a first sign that Moscow indeed intends to disrupt the supply of Western arms coming across the Polish border.
Plus, Ukraine's wartime economy evolved practically overnight, but how long can it survive? And could a court ruling in the Democratic Republic of the Congo upend China's natural resource ambitions in Africa? It's Monday, March 14th. I'm Luke Vargas with The Wall Street Journal. Here's the AM edition of What's News, the top headlines and business stories moving your world today. A Russian airstrike on a Ukrainian military training center in the city of Yavoriv, about 10 miles from the Polish border early on Sunday, has killed 35 people. The strike came one day after Moscow warned the West that it would consider arms deliveries to Ukraine as legitimate targets, and it could impede what has been a vital lifeline for Kyiv. WSJ National Security reporter Brett Forrest says the attack is indicative of Russia's intentions.
Russia is furious about the continued Western supply of arms into Ukraine and has especially noted Washington's role in giving Kyiv weapons that are increasing Moscow's human cost and frustrating its military campaign. Ukraine realizes it now has to diversify these Western supply routes and how they're protected. Russia has made an initial strike and a clear statement of further intent. We've now entered a stage of the war in which the Western part of Ukraine is in play.
Meanwhile, Russia has asked China for military equipment and other assistance for its war effort, according to U.S. officials, who didn't specify what Russia had requested. U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan told CNN on Sunday of the growing concern inside the Biden administration that Russia may be looking for help in the conflict. Sullivan said the U.S., quote, will not stand by and allow any country to compensate Russia for its losses from the economic sanctions. China has locked down the city of Shenzhen for a week after the country reported a dramatic spike in COVID-19 cases over the weekend. As the Journal's Peter Landers explains, the new health restrictions have already led to the closure of a Foxconn factory that makes products for Apple.
But this is likely to affect more than just iPhones. Companies like Huawei, which makes telecommunications equipment, and BYD, which makes electric vehicles and EV batteries, these companies are also based in Shenzhen. And so a lengthy shutdown could hurt the Chinese economy and impact the global supply chain. And it could mean higher inflation if supplies of some of these products for the global market come up short.
And we're exclusively reporting that Chinese technology giant Tencent is facing a record anti-money laundering fine over regulatory breaches and lapses in compliance on its payments network, WeChat Pay. Sources say Beijing regulators recently discovered the network had allowed the transfer and laundering of funds used in illicit transactions, including gambling. Tencent had previously been largely unscathed by a sweeping Chinese crackdown on major internet platforms that began in late 2020. The mineral cobalt has emerged as a critical material as the world transitions to cleaner energy. A single electric vehicle can require between 10 and 30 pounds to build its battery alone. But a major court ruling in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, home to the world's richest cobalt source, has sent shockwaves through the industry with potentially wide-reaching implications for China, the U.S., and the world. Nicholas Barrio is the WSJ correspondent for Uganda and Africa's Great Lakes region, and he joins us now with more. Nicholas, thank you for being with us. Could you tell us the latest about this court ruling in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, which involves the Chinese company China Molybdenum?
So in this ruling, this court appointed a temporary administrator who is actually from the state miner. So the ruling requires this administrator to take charge of the mine and sidelines the Chinese management for at least 6 months until auditors are able to evaluate whether this company, the Chinese, failed to declare tens of thousands of tons of copper and cobalt discovered at Tenke Fungume mine, which the state miner claims deprived it of millions of dollars in annual payments.
Nicholas, what is the DRC trying to do here in a bigger sense? Is this part of a larger push, perhaps, by the country to take control of this very lucrative cobalt industry?
Yeah, absolutely. So while the DRC controls 70% of mine production, China controls 66% of refining. But in this case, the DRC is trying to have a larger say because it's the largest source of this mineral, but does not control the market because the Chinese dominate refining.
And I understand this issue has become quite political within the Democratic Republic of the Congo now, as many there believe the country just isn't benefiting enough from the agreement made with this Chinese company. Is that correct?
Oh, yes. The DRC, despite having all these huge mineral resources, remains one of the poorest countries in the world, with a significant percentage of the population living under less than $2 a day, and most of them are unemployed, and there's widespread poverty. So in this case, the Congolese feel like they are not benefiting so much from this mineral wealth. And at the same time, when you look across the wider continent, commodity prices are skyrocketing, and most of these resource-rich nations tend to push for bigger share of proceeds from this industry as prices go up. Yes, so this is something that is likely to really spiral beyond the Congolese borders.
That was Nicholas Berrio, the Wall Street Journal's correspondent for Uganda and Africa's Great Lakes region. Nicholas, thanks so much for the time.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Coming up, as Ukraine fights for survival, what is happening to its economy? As Journal reporter Georgi Konchev explains, businesses across Ukraine are upending their operations in an effort to keep the government and military afloat. But is that enough? We'll have that story after the break.
Hello, I'm Laura Castleton, U.S. Head of Portfolio Construction and Strategy at Janus Henderson Investors. Is a brighter future possible? At Janus Henderson, we think it is. For 90 years, we've worked to help clients achieve superior financial outcomes and fulfill our purpose of investing in a brighter future together. We know that this means our thinking and our investments are helping to shape millions of brighter futures for the next 90 years and beyond. To learn more, go to janushenderson.com.
With its borders breached, its ports blocked, airspace closed, and millions of its citizens fleeing, Ukraine's economy, and the country as a whole, barely resembles what it looked like just weeks ago, before Russia's invasion. But thanks to quick thinking and creativity, Ukraine's economy has pivoted in the span of days, embracing an unconventional but very successful crowdfunding campaign to allow the state to pay its bills, in addition to rerouting supply chains and repurposing everything from factories to equipment. Journal reporter Georgi Konchev has been speaking to Ukrainians at the forefront of these changes, and he joins us now from Berlin. Hi, Georgi. Welcome.
Of course. My pleasure.
For anyone who's not familiar with Ukraine's economy, what was it known for before the war, and how has it been affected by Russia's invasion?
First of all, we have to say Ukraine is a relatively poor country. It's actually one of the poorest in Europe. So, of course, this war will disproportionately affect large swaths of the population. They have been, for years, a big exporter of agriculture. They're known as the breadbasket of Europe, which is an important export for them. And of course, in recent years, Ukraine has also managed to create this very vibrant IT technology sector with companies working with counterparts in the US, in Europe, in Asia. So they've been trying to diversify the economy and really get it going. And now, of course, this war is a big, big setback. But at the same time, they were able to do as much as they can to really adapt to the situation.
All right. So how have Ukrainian businesses adapted to the realities of war? I imagine it's harder for those in agriculture or manufacturing to adjust than it may be for a company in internet technology.
First of all, you're absolutely right on the service sector. A lot of these tech companies, they can work from pretty much anywhere, wherever they have an internet connection. So a lot of these companies have moved to the west of the country, which is relatively safe at this point. And they have been able to continue their work. Some of them, of course, have left the country and relocated to neighboring countries as well. In the manufacturing industry and others, There, obviously, we have factories that are closer, especially a lot of the factories of Ukraine are in the east, where a lot of the fighting is. So many of those companies have completely or partially closed shop. But some of these companies were able to, of course, to reroute some of their production to helping the military efforts.
And explain a bit more for us how certain companies that you've heard about have adjusted to actually supporting the war effort.
Absolutely. There's some examples of companies in the construction sector, for example, who have rerouted some of their production facilities to help the military. They've sent their trucks to help the military effort. They're producing all kinds of concrete blocks, for example, that are used in checkpoints to defend Kyiv. So companies themselves are trying to help as much as they can in the service sector. IT companies are also at the forefront. They're helping with all kinds of online activities, with marketing, public relations efforts, and other cybersecurity efforts. So ultimately, everyone is trying to do their bit.
What are business owners telling you about their circumstances right now? Are they getting paid when they are selling these goods and services to the Ukrainian military and government? And are they able to pay their staff?
In most cases, they're not getting paid. There's a huge dose of patriotism here that drives this. So the companies are definitely doing that to some extent out of patriotic duty. Of course, for some of those companies, it's also important to keep their employees employed as much as they can and keep paying salaries, although they're running down their reserves. So it's not easy for those companies to continue without production that they can sell for a long time. These companies that tell me they have runaway for another few weeks or another month, maybe to pay salaries, but after that, it's going to be tough. And overall, the Ukrainian economy right now, it's running at about 50% capacity.
Ukraine has also used some novel ways to fund its war effort. Crowdsourcing, for instance, for troops and for humanitarian aid has collected, you report, nearly $400 million so far. Could you tell us more about that?
Absolutely. It's really been quite incredible in terms of the speed. They were able to set up these crowdfunding accounts within hours of the Russians rolling into the country and starting these military strikes and operations. At the same time, they've issued war bonds to international investors, and that raised about $270 million. So it is comparable to what they can raise on the short term from international markets. And at the same time, they're also looking at other kind of novel ways to finance their state, their military operations. They're looking at NFTs, or these non-fungible tokens as well. And this is a planned fundraising measure in the short term as well.
And finally, Georgi, how sustainable are these changes that have been made to Ukraine's economy, considering that the damage being inflicted on the country by war is increasing with each passing day?
This is the key question here. And it's pretty clear that Ukraine will suffer a very severe economic shock. There'll be a deep recession. The damages to roads, bridges, railways, all of that, that would cost billions and billions of dollars. In fact, there is an estimate by the authorities that so far, in just in the first 2 weeks, infrastructure damage has exceeded $10 billion in damages. So all of this will need a lot more than, you know, the crowdfunding campaign. That's why Ukraine is in touch with the International Monetary Fund, with the World Bank, with the US government and other European partners to get direct aid as well. So Ukraine is doing as much as it can, but it will need help from the West.
That was Journal reporter Georgi Kontsev joining us today from Berlin. Georgi, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
And finally, in the first crucial days of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, social media played a huge role in drumming up outside support for the country. Videos of an exhausted yet defiant Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky have been widely shared. And as Andrew Chadwick, professor of political communications at the University of Loughborough, explains, Zelensky, a former comedian, understood the power of social media to reach a global audience.
I think what's happened is that digital media and social media have changed the game of warfare and wartime communications, and they've democratized it. And that makes these kinds of conflicts very different from the traditional understanding of conflicts that we inherited from the 20th century. And Zelensky recognized that.
You can check out our full video with more analysis of Zelensky's social media strategy on wsj.com/video. And that's What's News for Monday morning. We'll be back tonight with a new show. I'm Luke Vargas with The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for listening.
This episode is brought to you by Vanta. Vanta's trust management platform helps you quickly assess risk, streamline security reviews, and automate compliance for SOC 2, ISO 27001, and more. Learn how by watching Vanta's on-demand demo at vanta.com/WSJ.